Welcome to The Poison Room, a podcast that gives me an excuse to talk about the contents of ancient Greco-Egyptian magical formularies that happen to contain the name Moses in the title. Now that we have our background for the Theban Magical Library laid out, we can look at the specific text that brought us here in the first place, a 32-page codex containing the title, The Eighth Book of Moses. Actually, it has multiple titles, and actually there's more than one version of it. Nothing is ever simple in ancient Greco-Egyptian magical formularies. Oh, also, it doesn't have 32 pages anymore. The first leaf, i.e. the first two pages, is missing. But first, let's recap on why we have a Greco-Egyptian magical text that can claim Moses as an author. In episode 30, we explored where and when the idea of Mosaic authorship emerged. That's the idea that Moses wrote the Torah, also known as the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Hebrew Bible. It was an idea certainly already present by the Hellenistic period, as was the idea of Moses as someone capable of magic. I explained how it can be pretty hard to tell the difference between magic and religion. And just in case you can't hear the scare quotes around those words, be assured that they are there. And that even within Judaism, it wasn't always clear what was forbidden magic and what was welcomed divine intervention. Moses performs wondrous feats that are indistinguishable from wondrous feats produced by magicians and figures associated with magic. The same word can have a negative connotation in one instance, and even refer to a practitioner of something prohibited, and in another instance can refer to someone considered to be among the leaders of Jerusalem. And outside of Judaism? If you're an outsider looking in, the importance of the source of magic, our God versus your God, or gods, can seem far less important to you than to members of the source religion. Why should it be a distinguishing feature? I also talked about the fact that, by the beginning of the Common Era, Egypt was just strongly associated with magic as far as Greeks, Romans, and Jews were concerned. We ended by talking about how, when you get to a time and place like Greco-Roman Egypt, where lots of cultures, religions, and traditions are meeting, you inevitably end up with them mixing. This is referred to as syncretism. Once that happens, it gets very hard to look at a text that mentions Moses, Zeus, and Jesus, all as figures of authority, and calls on gods from every pantheon in town to respond to a ritualist's request or demand, and say, ah yes, this is a pagan text, or this is a Christian text, or this is a Jewish text, because they're not. They're syncretistic texts. They can require the reader or user to accept things that for some or many people in the source cultures or religions would not be acceptable. That, say, a text by Moses would involve invoking Zeus. On the other hand, the obvious non-Jewish elements do not preclude the idea that the text was written or used by people from a Jewish background or who considered themselves Jewish. As Lynn Lidonici observes, quote, Egyptian Jews had many different levels of observance, identification, and openness to religious input from their neighbours, and so the combination of a seemingly Jewish element with, e.g., Jesus, Osiris, or Bes, is not a reliable diagnostic criterion for exclusion of Jewish involvement. End quote. This idea might sound kinda bananas to some people. How can an observer of a monotheistic religion be happy to include polytheistic elements? To which I can only say, probably the same way some people today consider themselves Christians but still claim to believe in other supernatural powers, use tarot cards, go to seances, and hold ideas about heaven and the afterlife that are definitely at odds with mainstream Christianity. And there are certainly other Christians that would find their beliefs offensive or heretical. No doubt that was also the case in antiquity. So, after discussing this tradition of Moses and magic, in the last two episodes we looked at the genre of text which includes the Eighth Book of Moses. Texts that contain rituals aimed at finding out the future, healing wounds, murdering someone, or turning the ritualist invisible. Specifically, our text is part of a collection of magical formularies known as the Theban Magical Library, which contains texts ranging from the 2nd to the 4th century CE, and it is to the 4th century that the Eighth Book of Moses has been dated. As I said at the beginning, the first two pages are missing, but the text that we have actually begins on page 3 anyway. And there are two versions of the eighth book of Moses in the Codex, referred to as version A and version B, with version B being longer. The text was written by two different scribes. The first scribe wrote everything up to halfway down page 21. The second scribe picked up from there and continued on to page 25. If you've just done the maths, then you'll have noticed that leaves five pages still. They're blank. The text stops rather abruptly at that point. And by rather abruptly, I mean the scribe had started writing a recipe and got as far as to summon spirits, and then stopped, and then a little further along the same line wrote Moses, then on the next line wrote Mouseos Apocryphos E, Moses' secret, and a final word which no one has satisfactorily been able to decipher. Some scholars think it reads 10, and it is the title of a 10th book of Moses, but honestly, the letters just aren't there. Whatever it says, the second letter is clearly an omega, and 10, decati, would require an epsilon. Some have suggested that it's 8 again, but the letters, the decipherable ones, don't match up for that either. And the last few letters are just a mess, and the whole last line is a lot less neat than the previous lines. We don't know what happened here. We can but guess. If the scribe was copying it for a client, that client could have changed their mind. If they were copying it for themselves, they could have changed their mind. They could have put it aside for some reason, to eat, to sleep, to work on something else, and then never got back to it. Maybe the client couldn't pay. Maybe other stuff came up that was always more important. Maybe they had to get rid of it quickly. Maybe they died. Such mysteries is historical fiction spun from. I suppose at this point you might want to ask why or how there are two versions of it. Different versions are what happens when you've got texts being transmitted by people having to write them out and then pass them around and write them out again. Differences invariably creep in over time when that happens, though these two seem particularly unstable. Transmission of, I'd say most other texts actually, is a lot more stable than this. But errors increase when you're working with material that's difficult in the first place, or if you're copying something that's not in your primary language. In which case, you're not only more prone to make errors, but less likely to notice them or correct them, too. And if you're copying a more readily available text and you come across a variation or something that doesn't look quite right, you can go and look at other copies to see what they say. And if it turns out that the one you've got is deviating from most other versions, you can choose not to replicate that. That's not an option that's available to the people copying out this text. But the amount of differences between the two versions of the 8th book of Moses is very notable. It's led some to believe that A was deliberately edited to remove some of the Greco-Egyptian material in order to make it more palatable to a Jewish audience. But that's just speculation. So what's actually in our book? The main part of both versions is a lengthy ritual for an encounter with a supreme god, who will then reveal to the ritualist their future and disclose his, the supreme god's, real powerful name. The idea that knowing the true name of something gives you power over it is a very old, very widely used trope, from the goddess Angerona guarding the secret name of Rome to the idea that you need to know the name of a demon in order to exorcise it. It crops up everywhere. But despite the fact that knowing the real name of the supreme god lets you perform a handful of pretty cool spells that are appended to the end of version A, the main point of the ritual is the part where you find out your future. And this isn't some ask a question, get some vague answer type of divination. This is grab your writing implement, I'm about to info dump. And in version B, at least, if that future turns out to be not great, you can actually change it too. There are a lot of steps to the ritual. Some of them are the same between the two versions, some of them are different. Often one version will include a step that the other doesn't. Usually it's version B with the extra details. They're also a headache to read, because writing instructions is not a strength of the genre. They are all over the place. As in, you'll be halfway through reading the instructions on what to do on day 41, and suddenly you'll find it giving you instructions on something you should have done 7 days ago. I tried not to get into that in the last episode, and it's easy enough to gloss over when you're reading things that are only a few lines long, but these texts are both hundreds of lines long, and it is confusing. But in any case, much of it is similar to various ritual elements we've seen in other recipes in the Theban Magical Library. There's pre-ritual prep. In both A and B, you need to stay pure for 41 days, and you need to have done some maths to figure out when to start your purity period, based on when you want to actually perform the ritual, which should be when, well, scholars disagree about exactly when. At some point whilst the moon is in Aries. The word that's used in B often means eclipse, but it can also be used to refer to the waning moon. It might be the new moon, or it might be the last day of the old moon. You're also going to need an unclear amount of roosters and two pigeons. At some point in the ritual, they'll get sacrificed, or at least one of them will. You then set the other one free. I'm not going to mention them again. Back to the beginning. In version A of the text, before you get to the actual ritual for the meeting with the supreme god, there's another ritual which you have to perform on the new moon. Confusingly, the recipe states that you perform it on whatever new moon is auspicious, which probably means that you've done something to check whether the gods think this is a good day for you to do this ritual when it comes to the day itself. But you've already been told that you need to do it whilst the moon is in Aries, so this kind of implies that you have had to do the prep of keeping yourself pure for 41 days, and then when you get to the specified day, the gods may tell you, "No, not today, actually. Today's not good for us." But assuming you get the go-ahead, you need to make sure you've got some incense. 7 different types, to be precise, and also some cinnamon. You need this stuff for version B, too. It's just that there's no pre-ritual initiation. You still use it in the ritual itself. The cinnamon is apparently a pleasing smell to the supreme god, and another 7 gods you're going to be invoking all have incenses specific to them. Incense gets used a lot in ancient Egypt, especially in temples and religious rites. It was a big market. As Britta Eger points out, such heavy use of fragrances would help cover the scents of everyday life, creating an atmosphere more fitting for the presence of a god. And apparently creating an environment with such a strong olfactory component can also help create the conditions in which someone is more likely to be able to enter a trance-like state in which they might experience epiphanies or visions. Here, the smells are simply described as pleasing to different gods, but the function of incense in Egyptian ritual and religious ideas extends to identifying different incenses with different bodily secretions of the gods. It was an important enough part of ritual practice that depictions of a pharaoh or priest sensing a god is a standard scene in tombs and temples. Incense is not just a smell that is pleasing to the god, but also can be indicative of the presence of the god. So it makes sense that it would be considered a powerful tool in ritual. So we're still in our pre-ritual ritual in version A. The appropriate incenses have been gathered and the ritualist is instructed to use the incense to sense 3 specific items. The things that you have to sense are 3 flower figures that you've made. One is bull-faced, one is goat-faced, and the other ram-faced. Each one should be standing on a globe in the position of the celestial pole and holding an Egyptian flail. If you've ever seen, say, the sarcophagus of King Tutankhamun, you might remember that he has his arms crossed over his chest, and in one hand he holds a crook, and in the other a flail. This is the Egyptian flail. It's a symbol of the pharaoh's divine power. The idea of sensing a statue relates to a ritual known as the opening of the mouth, which was already an old tradition by the time our book was written. It was performed on statues of gods, probably also statues of the pharaoh, and later also on mummies and other various images and objects, such as the scarab that would be placed on a mummy. The point is believed to have been a symbolic or magical animation of the statue, to allow it to function as if it were a living being. In this ritual, I'd say the point is at least to infuse them with divine essence, though probably not to animate them as if they were living, because after sensing your 3 figures, you eat them. Eating is another trope that crops up all over the place in Egyptian magical and religious rituals. Apparently the verb to swallow could also be used to mean to know, so this is a literal enactment of that semantic overlap. Added to that, the verb for to taste could also have the nuance of to experience. And there are metaphors in English today that have the same kind of nuance. We might say, wine is an acquired taste, but we also say things like, they acquired a taste for adventure. And if someone talks of the sweet taste of joy, they're referring to just experiencing joy. Given that eating good food makes people strong and healthy, and eating bad food makes people ill, It's really easy to see how consuming a ritual or magic item would be thought to be an effective part of a rite. Back to our rituals. During the actual ritual for the encounter with the god, both versions A and B require the ritualist to engage in further acts of consumption. This time the ritualist has to write certain things on a block of natron, with ink that's been mixed with myrrh and the powder of specific flowers, and then lick the text off one side of the natron. For the text on the other side, the instruction is to pour wine over it over a bowl which already contains the milk of a black cow and wine not mixed with seawater, and then drink the resulting concoction. Natron, by the way, is sodium bicarbonate. It was widely used in mummification and purification practices, and its name derives from the same word as god or divine. You are using a divine substance on which to write your ritual, which you are then going to consume. There is no ingredient in this recipe that does not have some symbolic significance. This method of consumption of religious words or text is, again, a common trope, though this time not specifically Egyptian. There's actually an example of this exact thing in a different book of Moses, Numbers, or the fourth book of Moses. In chapter 5, verses 11 to 31, we are told that if a man suspects his wife of being pregnant with a child that is not his, he must take her to the priest along with some barley flour on her behalf. The text actually specifies that this flour should not be censed or have olive oil mixed with it, because it is an offering associated with wrongdoing. It's representative of the suspected sin, and thus you don't do anything to try and make it holy. Anyway, this is how the next few verses go. The priest shall bring her and have her stand before the Lord. Then he shall take some holy water in a clay jar and put some dust from the tabernacle floor into the water. After the priest has had the woman stand before the Lord, he shall loosen her hair and place in her hand the reminder offering, the grain offering for jealousy, while he himself holds the bitter water that brings a curse. Then the priest shall put the woman under oath and say to her, if no other man has had sexual relations with you, and you have not gone astray and become impure while married to your husband, may this bitter water that brings a curse not harm you. But if you have gone astray while married to your husband, and you have made yourself impure by having sexual relations with a man other than your husband, here the priest is to put the woman under this curse. May the Lord cause you to become a curse among your people when he makes your womb miscarry and your abdomen swell. May this water that brings a curse enter your body so that your abdomen swells or your womb miscarries. Then the woman is to say, Amen, so be it. The priest is to write these curses on a scroll and then wash them off into the bitter water. He shall make the woman drink the bitter water that brings a curse, and this water that brings a curse and causes bitter suffering will enter her. The priest is to take from her hands the grain offering for jealousy, wave it before the Lord, and bring it to the altar. The priest is then to take a handful of the grain offering as a memorial offering and burn it on the altar. After that, he is to have the woman drink the water. That's kind of similar sounding to some of the recipes in the magical formularies, right? It's a pretty good example of one man's magic is another man's religion, and why it's ropey to try and say, no, that's magic, no, that's religion. One of the things that does not come across with how I'm explaining parts of this text is exactly how much calculating and figuring out you need to do. For instance, there's a prayer you have to recite whilst eating the incensed flower statues, but our book doesn't tell you what exactly you need to say. No. Knowing what to say relies on having a second book at hand, referred to as the Key of Moses. This book presumably has a lot of tables in it because it tells you what the gods of the hour are and what the correct formulas are for them. So not only do you need to be doing this ritual on the correct day, but when you do it you need to be aware of the time so you can invoke the correct gods using the correct formulas. The key is mentioned in both version A and B, and in version A it's introduced with comments about how Hermes stole this information for his own book, The Wing. The Hermes being referred to here is Hermes Trismegistus, and that is a name that will invariably come up again in future episodes because he's a big figure in the early history of alchemy. Not that he actually existed, he's thought of as a god or divine sage. He's a combination of the Greek god Hermes and the Egyptian god Thot. Hermes Trismegistus was credited by some with the invention of Egyptian philosophy, arts, and sciences. And writings that get attributed to him cover astrological, botanical, alchemical, and magical treatises. Anyway, in version A, Hermes Trismegistus is said to have replicated the material in his book, which is just referred to as the Wing. Not only do we not have a surviving copy of it, but there's also no other source that even mentions it. And we do have other sources that talk about what Hermes supposedly wrote. So there's a possibility that the author of our 8th book wrote that Hermes took stuff from the Key of Moses for his own book, knowing that such a book did not exist. Which is a problem if it's supposed to be read as a genuine act of plagiarism, but not so much of a problem if the point is just, this other super powerful guy totally uses work by Moses too. In fact, in that instance, the non-existence of the book might be beneficial, because then the claim cannot be disproven. As to our Key of Moses, it very likely did exist. Our 8th book actually quotes from it once, rather than just citing it. The quote is, "On every occasion, prepare sun veg." The 8th book is useless without the key, so the options are that it did exist and whoever wrote the 8th book expected those reading it to also have access to the key, or that someone wrote the entire 8th book of Moses as an elaborate prank, including a fake quote from the key, knowing that no one would ever be able to complete it because they couldn't find the key, and that enough different scribes copied that text enough times that 2 final scribes could write competing but similar versions of that text together in one codex, and that they were all copying it despite not also being able to copy out the key. And given that we almost certainly do not have all of the contents of the Theban Magical Library, it's perfectly possible that there was also a copy of the key in there. But chances are, we will never know. Let's get back to our rituals. You've wafted incense, you've possibly eaten some flower statues, and now you get to the actual ritual for your encounter with the god. I am going to skip some stuff to do with writing down a name, which involves drawing a falcon-headed crocodile instead of letters representing hissing and snapping sounds, and also the 9-formed god, which the text states is known as the Ennead. The Ennead is normally just the name for a group of 9 gods who were involved in the creation in the Heliopolitan tradition. That's the tradition coming out of the city of Heliopolis. They're Atum, Shu, Tefnut, Geb, Nut, Osiris, Isis, Set, and Nephthys. In our text, the Ennead is imagined as one figure made up of the 9 gods, like a Megazord, I guess. And the falcon-faced crocodile is greeting the Ennead, and then there's a whole bunch of other stuff to write down, then the recipe sort of repeats itself for a bit, then eventually you get to a lengthy part that you have to recite. And that recitation involves something called a cosmopoios. It occurs in both versions, and it's a creation myth involving cachinnation, which is an unfortunately rare and delightfully onomatopoeic word for laughing. The primal god laughs another 7 gods into existence. I'm going to do us all a favour and miss out the parts where the Voces Mysticae names are assigned to each god. The scribe added a character count to the end of each one, and the longest one is a 49-letter palindrome. With that said, here's Todd Klutz's translation of the cosmopoios in version B, which I tweaked in a couple of places where I disagreed with his choices. The god laughed 7 times, ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka. When he laughed, 7 gods were begotten, who encompassed all things, for these are the ones that appeared first. When he cachinnated the first time, force, light, radiance appeared and divided everything into separate groups, and he became god over the world and the fire. He cachinnated a second time. All was water, but Ge, earth, hearing the sound and seeing radiance, was alarmed and arose into a heap, and the water became tripartite. A god appeared and was given charge of the abyss, and thus without him moisture neither increases nor decreases. When he was pleased to laugh the third time, Nous, mind, also known as thought, understanding as he does the heart, appeared because of the god's harshness. And he was called Hermes, through him everything was interpreted. He is also in charge of the faculties of thought, through which everything is managed. The god cachinnated the 4th time, and Gena fertility appeared, having control over the sowing of all things, and through whom all things were sown. He laughed the 5th time, and, after laughing, became gloomy, and Moira, destiny, appeared, and was holding scales, indicating that in her justice is to be found. But Hermes contended with her, saying, "In me is justice to be found." While they were fighting, God said to them, "Justice will be on both sides, but all things in the world will be subject to you, Moira Destiny." She was the first to receive the scepter of the world. He cacinated the sixth time and was made very happy. And Kairos Time appeared and was holding a scepter, indicating kingship. And he gave over the scepter to the first created god. Receiving it, the first created god said, "You, because you enveloped yourself in the glory of Fuos Light, will be with me, because you were the first to give me a scepter. All things will be under your control, things past and things yet to be. In you will be all power." When Kairos Time enveloped himself in the glory of Fuos Light, the manner of the light underwent a certain change of course. Then the god said to the queen, "Having enveloped yourself in the flux of Fuos Light, you will be with him, encompassing all things. You will increase by the light you receive from him, and again you will fall back because of him. With you, all things will increase and decrease." He cacinated the seventh time, panting, and both psyche, soul, and all kinds of things came into being. So the god said, "You will move all things, and with Hermes guiding you, all will be heartened." When the god said this, all things were put in motion and inspirited unstoppably. The god, seeing this, made the snapping noise, and all things were terrified. And because of the snapping noise, Phobos, fear, appeared, armed to the teeth. Then, turning toward the earth, the god made a loud hissing noise, and the earth was opened up when it received the noise. It gave birth to its own creature, the Pythian serpent, which foreknew all things through the utterance of the god. When the serpent appeared, the earth arose into a heap and was lifted up exceedingly high. But the celestial pole remained stable, so that the earth was about to collide with it. But the god said, "Aeor," with the result that everything came to a stop. Then a very great and mighty god appeared, who established the things that are now already past in the cosmos and also the things yet to be. Thereafter, none of the aerial bodies ever moved from its prescribed place. Phobos Fear, however, on seeing someone mightier than himself, opposed him and uttered the boast, "I am superior to you," to which the other, Aeor, replied, "But I established all things in their places." So the highest god intervened. "You, O serpent, are from a noise, but the god Aeor is from the very utterance itself. The utterance, truly, is better than the noise. Nonetheless, Aeor, the power of you who appeared last will derive not from yourself alone, but rather from the both of you, so that all things might indeed be established in their places." And wanting to give a grant of honour to his helper, since he had appeared together with him, the highest god gave him both leadership of the nine gods and possession of power and glory equal to theirs. And he was called by a name derived from the nine gods, by taking away, along with their power, also selected letters from their names. The Cosmopoios ends with Aeor being given another name that comprises parts of the names the other gods had been given, and then a couple more names just for good measure.
There is a lot going on in that, and we are not going to be able to discuss it all. But if you're familiar with the creation narrative in Genesis chapter 1, you might notice some of the similarities going on there. Light is created first on the first day, Fuos Radiance comes first. But then, in Genesis, the next thing to be created is the heavens, separating the waters below from the waters above, and it's day 3 when God creates dry land. But here, Ge, Earth, is second, and there's a different emphasis going on there too. God gathers the water so that dry land can appear. Ge, Earth, hears the god's laugh and responds to it herself, rising out of the water, and this leads to the water becoming tripartite. The fourth cacination leads to the creation of fertility, which you might compare to the second part of creation on day 3 in Genesis. Not only does the earth appear, but it also is made to be fruitful. Seed-bearing plants appear. But then the other gods that appear in our creation narrative are very different to what you find in Genesis. Justice, mind, time, fear. I mean, of course, the biggest difference is that the first god in our text is literally creating other gods. 8 gods from laughter, 1 from hissing, and then another through a word. The source for the creation of the 8 gods is in a group of Egyptian gods, 4 pairs, known as the Ogdoad. The development of the myth surrounding the Ogdoad is a story in itself, but what we care about is their role as cosmogonic deities, as primal deities whose appearances are part of the creation of the cosmos itself. And in this role, the myth can only be dated as early as the second part of the first millennium. Before then, they seemed to basically be gods specific to the city of Hermopolis, and their role was simply worshipping the sun, Ra, or Re. They appear in inscriptions during the 18th dynasty, which is 1550 to 1292 BCE, but they're still undifferentiated. Although the gods seem to have originated from Hermopolis, their mythology develops elsewhere. They don't appear in iconography until the 26th dynasty, that's 664 to 525 BCE. This is also when they finally receive individual names: Amon and Amonet, Nun and Nunet, Hehu and Hehet, Keku and Keket. The et suffix is a feminine suffix, so Amon is male, Amonet is female, Nun is male, Nunet is female, and so on. There's some difference in the names in different sources, but those are the most common. Their names represent qualities like boundlessness, mystery, chaos, and darkness, qualities of the primeval water from which they emerged. They're generally depicted as humans, with the males having frogs' heads and the females having snake heads. And when we finally do get a developed mythology of the Ogdoad, it comes out of Thebes. These deities created the world together, but then eventually died. Egyptian gods do that quite a lot. And thus moved to the underworld. From there they guarantee the functioning of the world, ensuring the sun rises and that the Nile flows. In different versions of the myth, the sun comes from different sources, but in the one that's of most interest to us, a lotus rises from the same waters as the Ogdoad, opens to reveal a scarab, which then becomes a male child, and from that child's tears come humans. Why is that of interest to us? Because of the laughter in our cosmogony. The laughter is also a definite Egyptian element. There are no gods being laughed into existence in Greek myths or Jewish lore. In fact, vocalization in general is not a popular trope in Greek cosmogonies. But there's a trope in Egyptian myths in which humans are created from the tears of the god, or come from his eyes, whereas the gods are created from his mouth. Often this is through speech or spit, as found in inscriptions at the temples of Tod and Edfu, but sometimes it's laughter. At the temple of Esna, we find this text: O Khnumre, lord of Esna, receiving the living lotus blossom which comes from the great lake in Hermopolis, made with the seed of the Ogdoad, in the high mound, at the beginning of existence. Its colour is gold, and its petals are true lapis lazuli, the august bud of his mother, the Ihet cow. He rose during his rejuvenation, and his body is august as Nefertem. As he opens his eye, he dispels the darkness, and created all that exists in this earth. The Ogdoad are in praise of his good face. He began works in the initial moment. As he cried, so came about people. They belonged to him as an army. As he laughed, so came about gods. He modelled the complete Aeneid. So our Cosmopoeias kind of mixes together the Aeneid and the Ogdoad, and then also adds in a clearly Greek element, the part where the god hisses and Earth brings forward her own creation, the Pythian snake. That is absolutely a Greek influence. When Apollo went looking for a place to set up his oracle, he ended up at Delphi, the navel of the world, according to the Greeks. The site was guarded by a dragon or snake, sometimes called the Python, which Apollo killed. His oracular priestess at the site is called the Pythia. Mixed in with the Pythian snake narrative, we also get the creation of the final god. And this part is particularly confusing. Phobosphere is created from a snapping noise. Then the god hisses at the earth receives the noise, opens up, and spawns the python. This causes some turmoil, which is halted when the god speaks a word, Aeor. With this, a final, powerful god appears. Then Phobosphere, made from the snapping noise, challenges this new god, claiming superiority. But it seems like Phobosphere is actually also the python, because in response to this challenge, the supreme god replies, addressing the serpent. He states that the word from which Aeor was created is superior to the noise from which the python was made. but then that Iorr's power will derive from both of them. And to go with that, in a line that I missed out because it's Voces Mysticae stuff, Iorr is then given a name, which is his name plus the Voces Mysticae that had been assigned to Phobos Fear. One scholar compares this to a story in a text known as the Memphite Theology. This is a text found recorded on a stone slab known as the Shabaka stone. The stone itself claims to be recording the remnants of a much older, decaying papyrus scroll. And for a while, Egyptologists actually bought that and considered it to be a recording of one of, if not the most, ancient stories from Memphis. Today, it's generally believed to be from the 25th dynasty, from 744 to 656 BCE. That makes it one of the latest cosmogonies recorded. The text makes Ptah the big creator deity, with Atum being Ptah's heart and tongue. The point of comparison with our Cosmopoios is that when Set and Horus are fighting over who is superior, they are stopped by Geb, who is the father of Osiris and Set, and thus grandfather of Horus. In other versions of this myth, the fight between Set and Horus is decided in other means, with some actual form of competition. But here, Geb just tells Set that he can rule over Upper Egypt, and Horus should rule over Lower Egypt. Then, however, Geb feels bad about the fact that he's apportioned them equal power and gives over his power to Horus. So they're not equal in the end. Just as, in our Cosmopoios, the supreme god seems to settle the dispute by saying that it will be the power of both of them that brings the universe into full order, but then goes on to give Iorr rulership over the other gods. We should probably take a moment to focus on Iorr's name, too. I mean the actual three-letter iota alpha omega word, Iorr. Vowel combinations are very common in the Voces Mysticae. Iorr appears often in lists that are just different vowel combinations. But Iorr was also certainly understood to be the name of Yahweh. Here, though, the role that he is taking is that of Horus. But Iorr, like the other gods here, despite how much power he gets given, is simply a detail in the story and deeds of the first supreme god. That's the god you're trying to arrange a meeting with. After you've recited the Cosmopoios, there's one final line to say, and then, if you've managed to do everything correctly, the god should appear to you, telling you many things which you should write down, including his name and your fate. In version B, if he tells you things you don't like, you can petition him to protect you against that fate and grant you a happier one. The curious thing about this is that the fate he's going to explain to you is fairly explicitly one based on your horoscope, i.e. it's based on where the stars were at the moment of your birth. This is a fate brought about by the fact that you were born at a very specific point in time, and yet our god can change that. This makes sense, I suppose, since it's Iorr that put everything in its place. The supreme god created the world and set everything in motion. When Iorr came along, he established the things that are now already past in the cosmos, and also the things yet to be. And part of establishing that is assuring that none of the aerial bodies ever moved from its prescribed place. The linking of what will happen in the future with the prescribing of paths for the aerial bodies is something that happens under Iorr. Our god, who was there before Iorr, who comes from a time before such things were established, has the power to intervene and change the rules. Appended to the end of version A is a list of spells that the ritualists can now use, because they all involve saying the secret name of the supreme god. These include three different recipes for invisibility, several for healing various ailments, one for killing birds by whispering the name in their ears, another for killing snakes, and recipes for protection from other spells, exorcism, sending dreams, raising the dead, calling up the sun, and my personal favourite, crossing the Nile on a crocodile. After that list of recipes, version A finishes with the lines, "You now possess in full, O child, the holy and fortune-bringing book, the Monad, which no one hitherto was able to translate or put into practice. Farewell, child." A began by introducing the book with two different names, Holy Book entitled Monad, or Eighth of Moses concerning the sacred name. Having one title at the top and one at the end is not unusual. Having two titles at the top is. But we're not stopping there. After the sign-off for version A, we then get the start of version B, which begins with Moses' holy book, secret, called the Eighth, or sacred. Which means, so far, the names are the Holy Monad Book, the Holy Eighth Book of Moses concerning the sacred name, Secret Holy Eighth Book of Moses, and the Secret Sacred Book of Moses. But we are not done collecting names. Version B ends, as version A does, with restating the title. But after restating that it's the Secret Eighth Book of Moses, the scribe adds that, in another manuscript they found, it said, the Secret Book of Moses concerning the Great Name, good for everything, containing the name of him who controls the universe. This messy situation with the names has led some scholars to assume that everything that comes after the first closing title in version B is part of a third book, for which the opening title is The Secret Book of Moses Concerning the Great Name, Good for Everything, blah blah blah. Others disagree and think that the remaining part of the text is basically an appendix. Personally, I'm in that camp because the remaining material just doesn't make a coherent whole, but parts of it clearly relate to what's gone before. Like, there's a whole bunch of stuff that's just, this is what the great name is in this text, this is what the great name is in that text. Even this, however, is not a full account of all the titles this book maybe has. Just before the closing title of version B is a table. The table relates to instructions in the recipes to find out who is ruling the celestial pole. It has two columns, one titled Greek and the other Seven Zoned. To begin with, you already need to know who rules the day in the Greek reckoning. Then, see where they are on the list. If they're fourth on the list in the Greek column, then you go across to the Seven Zoned column and count up four from the bottom. So, if you know that in the Greek reckoning, the day is ruled by Aries, you count down until you get to Aries, who is third on the list. Then you go across to the Seven Zoned column and count up three from the bottom to discover that Aphrodite is ruling the pole. Between the two columns, however, is another title. It says, The Monad of Moses, which is also a treatise called the Heptazone. Heptazone means Seven Zoned. So, once again, we have something labelled as the Monad, but Monad is the alternative title for the eighth book in version A. It's not used in the title of the text in version B, and the same table in version A doesn't have that title. You can see why it's confusing even just trying to figure out which text is named what, right? Calling a religious text holy or sacred is a no-brainer. That's not a mystery. Using secret for an esoteric text that trades in a currency of being rare and valuable and maybe also is potentially illegal to own at times is also obvious. But why eighth? What happened to the sixth and seventh? There's no mention of them in any ancient sources, but that doesn't mean much. There's no mention of the eighth book of Moses that we do have in any surviving ancient sources either. And yet here it is, and was circulated enough and transcribed enough to have ended up in at least these two different forms. The first possibility is that they existed, but were, or are currently, lost. If they did exist, then one would assume that whoever wrote the eighth book of Moses was probably at least aware of the existence of the sixth and seventh book. They could even potentially have been the author of those books, but this is purely speculation. We have no way of knowing, and it's not even the case that we can say that one possibility is more likely than any other. Given how many different titles our eighth book has, it's even possible that something like the Key of Moses, that's mentioned frequently throughout our texts, was also known as the sixth or seventh book of Moses in other sources. Tied in with all of this is the taboo question of whether the authors and users of the manuscripts genuinely thought these texts functioned as advertised. If they really thought they were writing something that had, at some point, come from Moses, then sure, they have to have believed that there were sixth and seventh books already in existence. That's how numbering systems work. But if the author was just someone wanting to write a title that would entice others to buy the work or convince them of its efficacy, then they could have chosen the number 8 for different reasons, such as a cool factor. The higher the number, the more secret the knowledge. This is also, as we all know, how numbering systems work. Everyone has access to the first 5 books of Moses. The other books of Moses are secret and for the initiated, and as a general rule with these kind of things, the higher the number, the more secret something is. You mastered the first book, now you get to read the second. Those who mastered the second book get to access the third, etc. The sixth book of Moses is just the one after the publicly available stuff. The seventh book contains stuff even those who have access to the sixth don't know, and the eighth book is for the people who are gifted enough to know the contents of those other seven books, and then some more. If that's the case, the benefits of this type of appeal to exclusivity were lost on the purveyors of fine magical pamphlets in 18th century Germany, which is where we're heading next. Thanks for listening. If you like the show, please subscribe, rate, etc. on whatever service you're using. If you have questions, comments, corrections, feedback, want to suggest a topic, etc., you can find the podcast on Twitter at Poison Room Pod, or send an email to poisonroompodcast@gmail.com. Transcripts of all episodes are available at poisonroom.com, where you can also see the references and bibliography. As always, if the sources are publicly available, they're linked to. Once again, I make no promises about when the next episode will be, because 18th century Europe is a very different place to 4th century Egypt, and I have a lot of reading to do. But I am working on it. You have been listening to The Poison Room. The voice in your ears has been able to get through this entire episode without ranting about Morton Bloody Smith. And if you're thinking, wait, that Morton Smith? Yes, that Morton Smith. And if you're not, you're lucky. And either way, you're welcome.